Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to another broadcast of The Business of the Business here on the Heritage Radio Network. This is Phil Colicchio coming to you from beautiful Bushwick, Brooklyn and Roberta's Restaurant. Just see this beautiful pizza being served in front of me. Always makes me happy to be here. And the show airs live every Wednesday at 5 p.m., except for this Wednesday at 5 p.m. You'll be hearing this next week. But most of our fans of the show like to listen to it live. If you can't catch it live, every once in a while somebody misses it, including the host. You can go to www.heritageradionetwork.org. You can click on to the Business of the Business icon, and you can listen to all of our shows that are archived. You can also listen as a podcast on iTunes. That's a big fad right now, people listening to this show as a podcast. But we're thrilled to be here every Wednesday to talk to you about the business of the hospitality business. This is an insider's look at the inner workings of restaurants, of hotels, of individual species of hospitality-related endeavors. And principally, it's a show dedicated to entrepreneurship. So let's get down to business. We've talked a lot about structure in the past. We've talked a lot about the integrity of work ethic. Today, what we're going to talk about is actually the mixture. We're going to talk about how to put together an idea, some financing, some family, and really create something that is kind of like a secret ingredient, something maybe that's like an elixir that really, once it's all said and done and the work is put in and the opportunity is honored, an elixir is created that fills a void, sometimes a void that people didn't know existed. We've got an interesting group today with us. We have my friend, Winston Justice. Winston is a professional football player. Notice we didn't bring that up right away because that's Winston's job. Winston doesn't view himself as special because he plays professional football for a living. Now, he looks like a football player. He's 6 foot six. He's about 300 pounds. But I think he's also, less than 300, Winston. I'm sorry.
I think I'm a little bit more than 300.
Well,
I haven't weighed myself on purpose for a couple weeks.
Well, I think you do whatever you want to do, all right, when it comes to this scale. And he's here with his wife, Danya Inatome Justice, and his brother-in-law, Evan Inatome.
Hello.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for having us.
You're very, very welcome. And thank you for coming out here today. So, Winston's here, Evan is here, because Evan had a business idea. Winston graduated from the University of Southern California, where I guess up to now, between college and professional careers, you've blocked for four Heisman Trophy winners?
Three.
Yeah. Are we counting one that got taken away?
No. I still count that.
All right.
If you want it.
I think that's right. Yeah. I think that's right. But I guess I was counting Mr. Andrew Luck as someone
Actually, he didn't win it. Robert Griffin III.
That's right. Well, he seems to have done all right without it, carrying that little grudge.
Yeah.
Winston was drafted in the second round out of USC by the Philadelphia Eagles. I first met him in Philadelphia. And he was immediately interested in the business that I do. He was interested in the hospitality business. We met originally at a fundraiser at the great Chef Mark Vetri's foundation dinner. And Winston was asking questions right and left to everyone who would answer him about the nature of their business. And I was very interested in this young guy who really was not self-absorbed at all. And I asked him what he thought he might want to do with this interest. And he said, well, you know, I've got this brother-in-law. He looks like a kid, but he's got this great idea. And he said it's for an espresso bar, kind of a coffee bar that is kind of a something he really has a vision for. And I smiled politely and thought, oh, that's very nice. You know, he's going to back his brother-in-law. I guess he has to do that. But then I met Evan, and Evan talked to me about what he wanted to do, and it was very clear what he wanted to do, and he did it. Winston and Evan opened up Elixir in Philadelphia, which really is the magic mixture, right? Isn't that really what Elixir is at the end of the day?
That was Dania's idea to name it.
Well, look at her. She's a stylish, intelligent woman. Dania and Winston are in town because they're both enrolled in the George Washington EMBA program.
Yeah.
Correct? Mm-hmm. Tell me a little about that before we talk about the coffee, because that's obviously a move that a lot of professional athletes should make, right? Because in doing our research for this show, we found out a terribly troubling statistic, particularly in football. Sports Illustrated reports that 78% of professional football players face financial difficulties within 2 years of their retirement from the game. Mm-hmm. Now, I know, also from reading, but also from talking to you, that the average football career is less than 2 years.
Yeah, I'm short.
And you also are involved in the Players Association, right? So you see all of these issues front and center, don't you?
Yeah, and that number is, you know, it keeps going up. It seems like that number, that statistic keeps going up, but it might be skewed because they take into account those players that come in for a game or 2 weeks, and then they never end up playing football again. But still, if it's 70%, it's still a high number, and they can't skew it that much.
That's right. You know, interesting, Winston, during the research, my executive producer provided an article for me in the research, written by a very well-written article, lots of insights by, of all folks, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Mm-hmm. And he wrote, and he actually concluded that football probably had a higher rate of economic distress after the game, partially because of the physical toll it takes on, on the players.
I think it's that, and one, players don't play that long, and they don't get paid as much as the big three sports. I mean, a basketball player and a baseball player, one, has guaranteed contracts, and two, they get paid more per year than a football player would.
Right.
Another reason is that football, and this is probably why it's so popular today in the United States, any game could be your last game, you know? You could go out against the Giants or Philly and that could be it.
Yeah.
You know? And I guess people like that. And
well, you've had that experience too, right? I mean, you've gotten injured enough that it was career-threatening, right?
Yeah. I mean, and if you play more than 4 years, everyone's going to be put in that situation, you know, right, either in college or in the NFL. And you know, I mean, it's going to happen because football is a violent sport, and sometimes people try to disconnect that.
Well, you obviously have seen that both from the trenches, as a student athlete, and then you had, you obviously had the vision to first reach out, date, and ultimately marry a beautiful, intelligent woman from a family of entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
Did you have an entrepreneurial spirit yourself?
I think really deep down in there. I think after I met Dania and then being around you know, her family and mm-hmm. especially Evan, which actually later on was my best friend after I met Dania, so it kind of worked out well.
The double whammy here.
You put
money into your best friend's business and your family's business.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad you're going to MBA school.
Yeah.
Because I'm not sure that's the first thing that they teach you in MBA school, right? Is that sometimes can create some issues.
I fell into it.
But you did it, right? But you did it. And so that entrepreneurial spirit that the Inotome family had seems like it awakened something in you.
Yeah, of course. And also having Evan kind of mentor me and point me in the right way to go, kind of, put me in the shame.
No. Well, let's hear from Evan, because what Evan's done is really an extraordinary thing. He opened up a relatively high-end coffee bar, espresso bar, in a city where he did not have his own roots. In Philadelphia, as I know firsthand, is not welcoming to people who have not grown up there. And it takes a while. Evan, why did you say Philly was the place to do this?
Well, I believe that our style of coffee, that's kind of like attention to detail in every part of from where we source the coffee to how we brew it, that has it started to trickle its way maybe 10 years ago to Portland and the West Coast, and then started to come to New York. But in terms of America, it's still kind of a new industry, and Philadelphia didn't have many places like this.
And you opened the first one in what year?
That was 2010.
2010. And you didn't really have a lot of other venues like that in Philadelphia in 2010,
no.
right?
No.
Now how many are there?
Now there's a handful, probably about eight.
Right. Yeah. Enough that Philadelphia Magazine and the New York Times feel like they can come down and rate them.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, anyone in the industry knows that Philadelphia is really a burgeoning scene on especially coffee. It's an exciting place to be right now.
Well, you know, up here in New York, it's a compliment. Wouldn't be a compliment in Philadelphia, but it's a compliment. Philadelphia is known as the sixth borough these days because so much great stuff is happening there from a food and beverage and hospitality standpoint. And people have realized that the I-95 corridor between New York and Philadelphia isn't really all that long. There's a lot more integration of food culture. And Philadelphia is no longer just the land of pretzels and cheesesteaks. Philadelphia is a culinary groundbreaking place.
Absolutely.
And just like I say, the people in Philly will get mad at me. The people in Brooklyn will get mad at me. I think that there's more going on in Philadelphia that's approachable and reasonable and frankly more spirited than what's going on in Brooklyn now. The Brooklyn was the capital of this for a very long time, still is, but Philadelphia is the equal of what I see going on in Brooklyn. So tell me about, so I want to do this. Winston, you're my friend, you're my brother-in-law, I want to do this. Did you give him a business plan?
I didn't give him anything in did I give you anything in writing? Maybe we made spreadsheets and things, but it wasn't
this probably doesn't really sound like the best thing, best example for, but I don't think you did. And one of the reasons, we went through with the deal is that I believed in Evan and I believed in his passion. And we're learning in business school that, you have to believe in the entrepreneur even more than product sometimes.
Well, for what it's worth, I didn't grow up in a house with lawyers or people who ran businesses, and I own a law firm and run a law firm. I have a cousin who's done pretty well in the food and beverage industry and the restaurant industry, who didn't go to college or culinary school. And Tom Colicchio seems to be pretty well represented out there among the elites in his business. So that part doesn't frighten me at all. I think the part that kind of scares me is you must have felt, Evan, incredible pressure to really follow through here.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good. Good. Because I bet they do teach you
that. I still feel that pressure.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. That those operators better feel some pressure.
I don't think you feel pressure from us, though. I think we you know, we're a family that really wants you to succeed and doesn't really mind if you fail or not, as long as you don't try. You
know? Well, I would say self-induced pressure.
Self-induced pressure.
I would feel that just like any endeavor, right, is that if I've asked people to trust me, and not just to trust me with their money, but to trust me with their, you know, with their hearts and with their souls, that I want to do the absolute best I can, and I don't want to fail. I don't want to just try hard. Mm. I want to try hard and succeed, you know, for them and for me. So we're going to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk about the details of the coffee business. I happen to know that it's got some pretty high margins. and that's what we talk about here on The Business of the Business. But the margins only work if the place is full. Phil Colicchio, Heritage Radio Network, The Business of the Business. Take a listen to our sponsors and those sweet Punch Brothers playing our theme song. And we'll be back shortly.
National Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Did you know HeritageRadioNetwork.org is a member-supported nonprofit organization? If you like what you're listening to, go to our website and click that donate button. Become a member and get special discounts, invites, VIP treatment, t-shirts, and more. Support us in our mission to bring you the freshest food content in the nation.
Welcome back to The Business of the Business here on the Heritage Radio Network. And I'm here with Winston Justice and Dania Anatome Justice, and the freezing cold Evan Anatome, who probably wishes he had a macchiato right now to take the edge off. It's a little cold in the studio. Evan, we get to a point. Your brother-in-law and sister-in-law are in Philadelphia. They're making a life in Philadelphia. He's got a bit of a profile in Philadelphia. You're going to open up a business. You're going to be open up to being judged by everybody.
Right.
You think football players get judged. You know, restaurateurs and hospitalitarians get judged at an equal rate with equal force. What did you do to get started? How'd you find this space?
Well, really found it by walking around. We found a spot that was available, and we thought it would be a great spot. I didn't know much about the city at the time. Dania kind of helped us. But when we got started, we were concerned about, you know, some of the same issues about, you know, are we good enough? What's the crowd going to be like?
Yep.
Is our pricing correct? And we didn't even tell anyone that we opened. We kind of just opened our doors. And I think that was good because we didn't have a lot of reporters. We didn't have a lot of press coming to check it out and giving us reviews that we didn't know if we'd be ready for.
Right.
And eventually, the people who were really into coffee started finding us too.
Yeah.
And they kind of spread the word. And we've had a pretty linear sales growth, and it's been fantastic, really. So
how did you find coffee as the product, as the widget? You know, you don't strike me out of the gate as a guy that was drinking coffee since he was five.
I really wasn't.
Really?
It was when I was in Indonesia. Really, I was living in Indonesia after the tsunami, doing tsunami relief work. And Indonesia, where a lot of you guys know, has a ton of coffee.
Yeah.
Coming out of Sumatra. We were living in Sumatra. And a lot of the people, you know, coffee was a big part of the culture. And right. I thought it was really fantastic the way everyone hung out together after work, before work, during work, over coffee.
And in Indonesia, was it prepared with the same level of care and skill?
No.
Yeah, tell me, right? This is a different...
Well, at the time, I thought it may... I really didn't know. Then when I got... I returned a couple years ago, and tasting that coffee was...
Really?
It's kind of disgusting.
So, so you take the culture of sort of the Indonesian let's have a gathering spot, mm-hmm. and the care and preparation that maybe the Europeans put into mm-hmm. their coffee and the importance that they put on their coffee.
Or even more so, I think a lot of companies are trying to progress coffee these days, doing their own experiments, playing around with different roast profiles. Mm-hmm. Playing around with different extraction methods, and I think coffee as a beverage is increasing. Farmers, you know, on the farm level, it's, you know, the kind of quality increases we've seen in the last 5-10 years have been fantastic.
I'm not sure whether wine is the new coffee or coffee is the new wine, right? I really don't know, because I know that there's that level of passion, that level of complexity in flavor profiles. Mm-hmm. So you do this in Philadelphia. What did you know you needed to do to be financially successful? And obviously, it's make more than you spend. But how did you break out labor costs? How did you break out product costs? Where did you?
Right. We did a lot. I mean, we did have a little bit of business. We did a lot of modeling. But the reality is, you don't know. It's all based on how many people come and how many cups of coffee go out the door. So you don't know what your traffic's going to be like. So it's really hard to predict, but you can, you know what your labor cost is going to be.
Yeah.
Like, right?
Well, one of the things we talk about, particularly in the restaurant industry, is really having a hold in managing those costs that are not fixed, mm-hmm. right? And labor is usually that. Labor is usually the one you live and die by, mm-hmm. meaning, am I staffing this right? Do I have too much staff? If I have too much staff, I'm not going to make money. I know what my product costs usually. Although you're in a commodities business, mm-hmm. does the pricing of coffee vary on a quarterly basis?
No, not on an annual basis. It kind of does. The places that buy their coffee from roasters that like we do, mm-hmm. it kind of changes once a year or in between there, and it's. And the commodities, you know, if you're the actual roaster, it's changing quite frequently. Last year, prices were significantly higher for the roasters to get coffee than they are now. But at the retail level, we're paying about the same as we were paying last year. So.
Oh, really? So who's getting hurt, the roasters?
No. I would say the retailers are getting, well, no, I wouldn't say hurt, but mm-hmm. the roasters are keeping all the benefits.
Okay. Now, I love talking about the aromas and the flavors, and I really do love talking about that, but that's not what the show is about, right? Mm-hmm. The show is really about how do you earn a living doing this. Mm-hmm. So your first one, how long did it take before you showed profit?
We were right around break even and maybe about 4 or 5 months into it, but I wasn't taking a salary.
Mm-hmm.
And we had, you know, high real estate costs.
Yep.
So it really wasn't until the next fall where we started really seeing some money come in.
And that gave you enough of an impetus to open a second store?
Well, yeah. Actually, after that first summer, They told us that we still only have one story. They told us we had to move because they were going to demolish the building, which is a nightmare at the time.
You know, I'm glad I wasn't the lawyer who negotiated that lease, or I think you'd be knocking on my door. Wow.
Well, really, they kind of put that in the lease, but also they worked that into our rent. So we had really cheap rent in a nice location.
Good.
And so we didn't build out our first spot as nicely as we probably would have liked to if we know we were going to be there for a long time.
Right.
So.
Now, your second spot, I've seen it. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful. I it reminds me a great deal of the concept that the terroir wine bars here in New York put out there, which is a very communal environment, a rustic environment, certainly enough of an environment where you can have coffee and talk to your friend. Or you can easily meet someone with a similar interest, and it's communal, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. we like to have a little bit for everyone. If you want to work, we have some tables. If you want to chat, we have a bunch of lounge type area.
Right. Now you and I were talking a little bit before the show about the what I think is the amazing coffee concession at the Ace Hotel, which is run by Stumptown. Mm-hmm. You don't view yourself as the Stumptown alternative, right?
No, I mean, I think there's some similarities between mm-hmm. our. I think that if you ask people who are into the coffee and Phil, I think that we have a lot of creativity like Stumptown does.
Mm-hmm.
A bunch of creative people are in that company, from the roasters to the baristas,
right.
And you can kind of see that in the product and what they do.
I'm very impressed with how they operate their business.
Yeah.
So I think I could use that as a business model. And did you? Was there a business model? I mean, I know it wasn't Starbucks. What was your business? Because Starbucks business model included losing money for about 5 years,
right.
You know, before it became profitable. Winston, have you yet read the Starbucks business reports on that?
No.
Their business model was about real estate, and it was about getting the best real estate they could get, knowing that they were not going to be able to keep up with their expenses for a period of time.
Mm.
So they funded. Now, if Evan had come to you and said, hey, Winston, I have this great idea, but we're not going to see any profit for a year or two,
mm-hmm.
would you still have invested in it?
I don't know, because that didn't happen. I mean,
yeah.
So, I mean, my answer would have been different.
I mean, yeah, it probably would have. And, yeah. I, you know, again, they start out with a concept that works, and then you get somebody to invest a lot of money in it mm-hmm. with the idea that it's going to grow to that level. Have you thought about taking Elixir? I know that it's so good that a number of restaurants in Philadelphia ask you to provide the coffee for them.
Mm-hmm.
Including our mutual friend Kevin Spraga,
right?
And is that going to become part of what your brand is about? You're going to be able to provide that too?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly something we think about having our own roasted coffee.
Mm-hmm.
You can control, you know, the quality a little bit further than, you know, blindly trusting. And these are great people that we get our coffee from. We have what's called a multi-roaster model, where you kind of find the best coffee from the best roasters from across the country, and you showcase them at your shop. But there is a little bit of a blind trust. I wouldn't say blind, but you're kind of just trusting that what you order, you know, nothing funny happened between mm-hmm. when it you know, you ordered that and when it got to you. If we have that, you know, control over the coffee, it's something we think about, and absolutely.
Good. In the second store, you mentioned you fit it out more significantly mm-hmm. with more thought, with more design. Winston, did you get involved? Dania, did you get involved in the design of the second shop?
We went to the the bare model when nothing was there, and Evan really had a vision on like what to like put there and stuff, because I had no idea.
They're in Indianapolis.
So I mean, but this was right before I was traded to Indy,
right.
And you know, we had some different views on it, but we defaulted to Evan because he's the expert. So, I mean, the place now is great. So,
and what did it? Give me an idea. What did it cost? Because when I work with restaurateurs, you know, we talk about how much money the build out is going to cost, mm-hmm. and how much it's going to take, how much time it's going to take to repay it. Were you able to get landlord contribution on this one?
A little bit. We had them put in the air conditioning unit and a bathroom.
Right. And what did you? What kind of budget did you have?
I really didn't have a budget because I didn't know. It was kind of something that we were formulating as we got these ideas coming in. It took a long time, and we had a lot of input from different people, and it wasn't the most efficient way of doing it because we all worked on little parts of the shop, but it turned out fantastic.
Yeah. Well, now you have a model. Is it a model you want to replicate? Do you want to take it to other cities?
The other thing I should mention is we got picketed by the union, by the Carpenters Union, for probably about 6 months after we
really?
Opened. Yeah.
Tell me. Did they put the rat out there?
They didn't put the rat, but outside, right outside of our shop, but it was down the street, and they had, you know, some big guys right outside of the shop handing out flyers with my cell phone number on it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
All right.
It costed about I think like $150,000.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty well done.
I was also doing the floors myself.
Really?
Yeah.
So you've got see, now I thought that was coffee stains on your hand. Instead, it's varnish, isn't it? We're only a 30-minute show. Our producer, Jack Inslee, keeps telling me we should really make it an hour. I tell him that that's probably too long, Jack, but we may talk about that. But this is something I could talk about for a long time because, again, entrepreneurship, something not just near and dear to my heart, something I participate in, something I invest in, and something I do myself every day. I got to ask, to me, the big questions. Winston and Evan and Dania, what was the biggest mistake that you made in this process, and how did you overcome it? I think when people listen to the show, they want to take something away that says, man, I'm afraid to start a business. I could wind up being one of the 78%, right, of some of the people who don't make it, right? But you got to overcome mistakes, whether it's in sports, whether it's in being an entrepreneur, or whether it's being a barista, whether it's being an engineer out there in the control room. What was the biggest mistake that you bumped into, and how'd you overcome it?
I think one of the biggest I wouldn't say mistakes, but hiring is always a huge thing overhead, and if you have the wrong people on, it's really hard to get them, you know, out of the company. But I think if I was starting again, I would make sure to do every part from the build out, from the products, everything with quality. I think quality is the one thing that an entrepreneur can have to distinguish themselves. Entrepreneurs can't win on cost. They're always going to pay more than Starbucks gets their coffee for, or more for paper even than Starbucks gets, more for everything than all these other people get them for. They're not established, but the one thing that we really have control over is quality. So you have to go big. You have to really think about the details, from, you know, what it looks like even in the restroom to prepare for, you know, when we open with not a lot of cash, and that was hard for us. You know, I was actually late paying my first income taxes, or not income tax, my sales taxes, which hurt me. You know, I had to pay thousands of dollars in penalties after. I really wasn't prepared for it.
That's a good takeaway. Don't do that, restaurateurs, no matter what. Even if you have to go to your brother-in-law to borrow a few bucks, make sure you pay your taxes. Winston, is this a business that you see yourself staying in, that you see yourself investing in the future, that you might bring other of your colleagues, whether they be professional athletes or others, into this business to grow it?
I think it depends on the deal that I see in the future. I think it could be really up and down. I mean, people do invest in restaurants and they lose a lot of money.
Yes, they do.
So you need to be, it's really important that you're with the right people and you have the right people on your team. I just happen to be in the perfect situation to have the right people. But most guys don't. And I'll just tell them to proceed with caution.
Good advice. Sound like a lawyer. Dania, Winston, and Evan, thanks for coming in today. I look forward to the growth of Elixir. I hope to see it outside of Philadelphia soon. I'm going to hope you keep me posted about anything new that's going to go on. Before we leave, the website, the address, tell everybody. People head down to Philadelphia all the time.
ElixirCoffee.com, E-L-I-X-R, coffee, C-O-F-F-E.com.
E-L-I-X-R, very right. Good. What's the address?
207 South Sydenham Street.
In Philadelphia. There we go. And if anybody wants Evan's cell phone number, they can reach out to the United Brotherhood of Carpenters in Philadelphia, and they'll provide it. Thanks for spending time with us. Phil Colicchio signing off for the Business of the Business on Heritage Radio Network. See you next week. What about a pizza? Yeah? Yeah? Yeah. All right.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.